This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Good morning. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I am your co-host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. I alternate weeks with our other inimitable co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, and we are delighted that you are here. This morning, we continue our mission of the Docs for Patient Care Foundation of defending the sanctity of the doctor-patient relationship and its central, irreplaceable position in our healthcare system, to promote the freedom of choice in healthcare, to support the consolidation and streamlining and simplification, some common sense in the regulations on healthcare, in which there is none now. We have over 100,000 pages of regulations that apply to the behavior of healthcare providers. That is an unworkable situation. And finally, and my biggest point of personal interest, is to support the intelligent, effective, and safe use of health information technology. And that is coming right to the forefront. And on the way into the studio this morning, literally less than 15 minutes ago, I heard stuff on the radio coming in that applies directly to our show today. And I spent the last 90 seconds frantically scribbling changes to the program notes that we are going to get to. But, you know, it feels like the ground is literally shifting under our feet in this whole issue of data security and the question of how safe is your medical data? How safe is your personal data? And we're also going to talk about, in the case of doctors, is, you know, how safe are you, period, in the wake of recent shootings of physicians in some very prominent places that one would assume would be safe. My son, Andrew, is straining under the weight of probably the hardest part of his high school career, perhaps the hardest part of anybody's high school career, which is that spring of junior year when the college admission process is ramping up and the grades become so important. And of course, you know, like any good parent, try to help him with his studies as much as you can. And currently, he is reading Orwell's book, George Orwell's famous book that we all know, 1984. And I'm kind of embarrassed to admit that I've never read the book cover to cover. And I had forgotten that until we were talking about the book, and I kept telling him I didn't know much about it. And he finally was incredulous to discover that I hadn't read it. I was kind of familiar with it. I hadn't read it, but the more I'm learning about the book in a more of a cover to cover way, the more I realize so much of what's in there, you know, not only applies to society in general, as we all know, but it also applies to healthcare and applies to the rapid and poorly managed, poorly understood changes to how our healthcare is delivered. At this point, I was going to go on to some of the more generic sort of comments I like to make about what we do on the show, and I am going to get to those. But before I get more than a couple of minutes deep into the first segment, I have to bring you what I guess would be considered to be breaking news. I guess that's kind of a phrase that doesn't get used much in this sort of an internet-based chat radio setting. But literally on the way in the car, while I'm worried about, you know, getting here on time, I hear on the radio that I listen to, you know, on the way in, of yet another major data security breach in healthcare this time, perhaps the largest data breach, certainly involving healthcare, but maybe the largest data breach ever, involving as many as 80 million healthcare records. And this occurred at Anthem, Blue Cross Blue Shield, you know, an insurer that is regarded by some to be the second largest insurer in the United States, with over 80 million, you know, records that are either healthcare directly or healthcare related demographic records and whatnot, and it's been breached. This was announced yesterday, you know, the claim that they make that it's okay because they didn't get medical records per se. Well, they got names, dates of birth, billing addresses, social security numbers, not credit card numbers, hopefully. You know, we have a huge problem, and it's not only current customers of Blue Cross Blue Shield, but past customers of Blue Cross Blue Shield. And so, you know, the number, you know, depending on the source that you read, is either 69 million or 80 million, but it includes both present and past customers. So if you're listening to this and saying, well, that's okay, I'm not a Blue Cross Blue Shield customer now, well, if you have ever been a Blue Cross Blue Shield customer in the past, your data are at risk. your not your credit card numbers, but your social security number, your date of birth, those things that are required, and that's all that's required to establish an alternate identity in your name and wreak havoc on your personal life and your financial life. And clearly, and I'm jumping ahead here, I was going to get this to the end, so if it's a little disorganized, I apologize in advance, but I felt like we had to cover this in the first 5 minutes of the program because it is so important, and the arguments behind why we have such a problem here are so important. Clearly, this data security thing is a major unsolved problem. The information technology community is not ahead of this problem. They don't have the answers we need. We are getting, you know, it seems that the hackers can just walk in at will. I mean, it's like taking all the guards away from Fort Knox and unlocking the doors and saying, help yourself to the gold because we're not going to guard it. I mean, that's really the way it feels. Because remember, this Blue Cross Blue Shield, this Anthem, WellPoint, however, whatever name you want to use, you know, this data breach is just the latest. Now, this is just the latest in a string of huge breaches, tens of millions of records, right? I mean, what were we talking about last month? We were talking about the breach of Sony, right? Maybe it was North Korea, maybe it wasn't. You know, in a sense, it doesn't matter. You know, if your data are breached and it's gone and suddenly, you know, identity thieves have this to use, you know, it almost doesn't matter who stole it because if you catch them, there's going to be somebody else right behind them in some relatively underdeveloped country probably, but maybe not, perhaps right inside our own borders, that will step up and steal this stuff again because it appears to be so easy, right? Who do we have? Blue Cross Blue Shield announced yesterday, Sony, Target, Home Depot, even the U.S. government, the U.S. military, at their social media, you know, there was a breach. So, you know, there's no security here. There's no privacy here. There's no safety here. And, you know, we're setting ducks. We're all setting ducks. And I don't care how hard you've worked to, you know, push your IT people to make your data as secure as it can be. You know, the bottom line is, you know, I feel like I've, you know, put all of my personal savings in my car and left it in the mall parking lot overnight with the doors unlocked and a big sign that says, you know, come check this out, because that's kind of how it feels. And all of the trends that the government is pushing is making this worse. Right? And I hate to keep, you know, riding on meaningful use and electronic medical record incentive programs. I hate to sound like a broken record, but this is yet another angle, in which, you know, the government's intervention is making this worse. How? Well, of course, you know, pushing everyone to get all of their medical records online through an electronic medical record before the medical community is ready, clearly before the IT community is ready, has now, you know, got us going from, you know, 4% of providers that had records online in 2008 to something to the tune of 70 to 75% of providers. So you're talking a net gain of probably 700,000 physicians, and each of those probably having on the order of, you know, 50 to 100,000 records per physician, or maybe a little less, but a lot to be sure. And if you do all that arithmetic, you find that, you know, basically we are all in a situation where we have health records in an electronic format stored on a centralized server whose security and level of protection is not adequate. And it appears, you know, from the range of hacking victims that are on this list, that there's no piece that's safe. You know, obviously it's inside of healthcare, outside of healthcare, and you know, within healthcare at least, you know, thanks to the government, the emphasis is all wrong, because all of the rhetoric that surrounds the HIPAA omnibus and all of the regulations regarding the security and privacy of, you know, personal, you know, protected health information, PHI, however you wish to refer to it, is again misguided. And, you know, of course, as the compliance officer for our organization, our medical association, our practice, you know, I've looked into this as best I can and spent hours on evenings and weekends looking at what's on CMS.gov and HIPAA and, you know, in the public and the private sector. And again, the emphasis is all wrong. The emphasis is all wrong. They're talking about, you know, changing the culture within the office to make sure that you don't give out passwords, and that's fine as far as it goes, but don't tell me that the theft of 80 million records at Anthem was because somebody in a doctor's office gave away a password. That's impossible, because they didn't even hack it from a Reddit medical records side. They hacked it from a, you know, presumed central server someplace within Blue Cross Blue Shield Anthem. And, you know, there was no healthcare worker there that gave away a password. There was no physician who left a laptop open. That's not where this happened. And yet that's where all of the cultural emphasis comes from. If you look at CMS.gov and related sites and web pages, you know, I took a, they have a little quiz that you take or a course that you take where they present certain situations in front of you, little stuff, you know, data breaches that involve one record at a time, two records at a time. You know, that's not where this is happening. That's not where this is happening. There's been a major shift. A year ago, when I was talking about this sort of thing, I was saying that the major risk to protected health information was the theft of physical media, right? A physician has a bunch of patient records on his or her laptop that's part of a research project, or a bunch of floppy disks. We don't even use floppy disks anymore, or a thumb drive, or some sort of physical media, and that physical media gets physically lost or physically stolen. But that's no longer the case. That's no longer the highest risk problem. Used to be. Year or two ago, that's what I would have talked about. Now, I think that's gone by the wayside, and why should hackers waste their time stealing one record at a time, two records at a time, 1,000 records at a time? Because that's small potatoes now. That's nothing when you can go to Blue Cross and Blue Shield and steal 80 million records, or you can go to Sony and steal extremely valuable proprietary information and financial information and emails. So, you know, again, the breadth and depth of the victims and the kind of information that's being stolen, I think pretty clearly demonstrates that the IT community does not have its act together yet, and that, you know, thanks to the climate we have and the incentives and penalties that we have in place for the premature, dangerously accelerated adoption of electronic medical records, that we have really put ourselves in a quandary, because the records are there, they're online. You know, how do we turn the clock back? You know, we can't hit the undo key, you can't hit Control Z on the keyboard and just kind of undo this and make it like that never happened. We need to find some other way out of this, and quite frankly, I don't know that solution is obvious. I really don't know. So we'll get back to what we're supposed to do here. I had to take that little detour because of the timeliness of the news, the importance it is for you to know that, and the importance of you, our listeners, to understand how much at risk you are, because it's not obvious. I mean, the rules of the game for stealing data are different than the rules for stealing something physical. Right? If you steal something physical, when you go there, it's gone. Right? If you steal data, when you go there, the data is still in your server. So it would suggest that, you know, for every one breach that we know of that makes the headlines, that gets goofheads like me talking in front of a microphone about stuff, that there's how many? 5, 10, 100 more episodes of data breaches and potential identity theft that you never know. I mean, heck, you know, someone could have, you know, broken into, you know, our database last night or in the middle of the day. And how would you know? You might see a little transient system slow down as your entire database is dumped somewhere else. But otherwise, the system's going to continue to run. The records are going to be there. It's not stealing something physical, right? Somebody steals your car. You go to the garage the next morning and the car's gone, or you come out from the mall and the car's gone. This is a completely different set of rules here. So there's no question when it comes to the security of our digitized data, our personal information, I think we are in big trouble. We're at the end of segment one. It's 15 minutes after the hour. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your health care freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
Don't be hoodwinked by the left, who wants you to believe the fairy tale that we can power America on butterflies, rainbows, and pixie dust. I'm Marita Noon. Get the truth about energy on my show, America's Voice for Energy, only on America's Web Radio.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Back again. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I am your host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thank you for spending some of your time with us today. We're very grateful to have you with us. We're going to go back to the original programming notes here that we were going to do. I had to take a little detour on the first segment because of the breaking news as of yesterday that Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield, the second largest private insurer in the United States, has announced that the records of 80 million individuals have been hacked, have been stolen. And so we spent the first segment talking about how in healthcare, as well as everywhere else, I mean, we are sitting ducks with our data out there, and that clearly, you know, something's got to be done because your data is not safe. It's just not. They're on big servers. They're on server farms in remote locations, and you don't have any way of knowing how safe the data are on those servers that relate to you, your social security number, your billing address, your date of birth, all of that stuff. And all of this is part of a bigger movement, right? This is a movement that's happening that probably started decades ago, probably started in the 1980s, probably to be sure, probably started with the advent of managed care when the competitive stakeholders, as I call them, in healthcare, the folks who are stakeholders in healthcare that are not physicians, that do not touch patients for a living, doctors, nurses, therapists, etc., that want to change how the world perceives physicians. They want to convince you, they want to propagandize you, just made up a verb there, they want to indoctrinate you that physicians are not special. That healthcare is not special, that there's nothing special about when a doctor and a patient go into an exam room, have a conversation, get to know each other, and make very important decisions about that patient's healthcare, that's not a big deal. That's not really special. Really, the big deal about what happens with that doctor and that patient in the exam room is the billing event. It's not about the care. It's about the billing. It's about the data collection. It's about being just a cog in a great big machine. So it is our intent, at least my intent, when this microphone's in front of me, when I have that privilege, to fight that propaganda, to modify the path that healthcare is taking. Not necessarily to fight it. Right? I'm not here to say that all of the technology and that all of the consolidation and all those things are bad in their essential nature. I am here to say that the way it's being executed by the stakeholders in healthcare who are not physicians, who don't understand what it takes to make a sick person well, are making a huge mistake in the way that they are implementing an otherwise valid concept. So I'm here, at least when it's my turn, to remind you, to re-educate you, to correctly indoctrinate you and fight the propaganda regarding who physicians really are and why the work physicians do is so different from any other profession around. Healthcare is different, and it should be regarded differently. And the problem is we have healthcare executives, we have CEOs, we have administrators, we have insurers, and we have politicians, right? We have even the president himself trying to convince you that doctors are different than who we are, that we are money grubbers, that we are cold, that we are disposable, that we are replaceable, that, you know, we can take an untrained person with a protocol or care guidelines and deliver the same results that you can with a real doctor talking to a real patient about real medical care. So remember these sound bites. You're going to remember these. I'm going to play them and make a slightly different point that you've heard. But I think you've heard this one before. I hope this works.
Make sure that we're also reimbursing the care that prevents the amputation. Nurses.
Right, that was President Obama. I'm not sure what happened to the first one. Here's the one I wanted. I had the wrong one up here. Let's get the right one. Okay. This is President Obama talking about Obamacare back in 2008, 2009 when this was all being very hotly debated. This is the one I wanted to play first. Try this.
System and say to himself, you know what? I make a lot more money if I take this kid's tonsils out.
Remember that? Right, that was that little soundbite. That little press conference was actually the very first night that I got involved with talk radio as a caller. This was back in the days in Atlanta when Herman Cain's show, which is now in the morning, was in the evening. And I called in and I said, "This is ridiculous. President Obama has no idea what doctors are thinking when they make their medical decisions." And I assure you, especially in the case of a tonsillectomy, which I do—that's my specialty. He's talking about, you know, have nothing to do with that. But we're going to play that soundbite in combination with this one. This was the one where Obama was a little misguided about how much doctors pay for or get paid to perform an amputation. Listen.
If that same diabetic ends up getting their foot amputated, that's $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 immediately. The surgeon is reimbursed.
$50,000? Really?
Make sure that we're also reimbursing the care that prevents the amputation. Nurses.
Okay, so clearly what he was trying to do, and again, this is with, you know, 5 years of perspective here, you know, I think he knew what he was talking about, but it was, you know, probably the best, most flagrant example that I can find of a competitive stakeholder in the healthcare system trying to convince you, and even tried to convince doctors to doubt ourselves, but trying to convince you that we are different than who we really are. That we get paid huge amounts of money. We're getting $50,000 for an operation. Are you kidding? I mean, he knew what he was talking about. I mean, this is just a way to incite class warfare. And again, this is not a Democratic thing or a Republican thing. And I don't want to mislead you in terms of where I am coming from. You know, I picked two Obama examples because I remember them, of course, and, you know, because they come from the highest office in the land, I thought it was a good example. But make no mistake, this is not a Democratic thing. This is not a liberal thing versus a conservative thing. This is happening everywhere. Politicians, regardless of whether there's a D or an R after their name, you know, how they regard themselves or how others regard them, this stuff is happening all over the place. That the doctors are not special, that we do not have any higher motivations or higher aspirations, that medicine's not a calling, that it's, you know, merely a place to go to work and make money and come home. And I think, you know, the time when Obamacare was being litigated, I think I would probably call this the low point. I think this was the low point in doctor influence, because it was right around this time when Hal Schurz talked to folks that he knew, and we all got together in 2008, 2009 in Hal's waiting room and formed Docs for Patient Care, the C6, because we saw that low point and said something's got to give. I mean, not only was the president audacious enough to actually say this stuff, but he got away with it. He got away with it because there was no concerted physician response. There was no organized response. There was lots of, you know, grumbling people around the water cooler and maybe one or two isolated people like me calling into, you know, evening talk radio shows about it. But there was no organized response. There was no concerted response. And things have gotten better since then, I think. And we're going to get to that in a minute. I'm going to give you one more piece of data about the low point. And this was this is a blog post that's been out probably a year or two. And it was a story written by a radiologist. And it's I don't think it's literally true. So if you listen to this in the next 10 or 15, 30 seconds, I think this was all sort of a metaphor or maybe even an allegory. Love that word. That's some kind of SAT word. And remember, I'm helping my son study for SATs and English class, so fancy words like allegories slip in once in a while. Apologize for that. But this is a story about a physician who goes to meet with one of his hospital administrators or CEOs and finds this document sitting in the waiting room. And the document is the top five things that you can do to discourage physicians. And so he picks this thing up and reads it, and it turns out to be a training manual for hospital executives on how to demoralize physicians, how to dominate physicians. And again, I don't think it's literal. I don't think it's actually real. And if you read it and you look over it, you say, okay, this was kind of a fact-based parable, perhaps, is how the author refers to it. But the stuff that's written in here is so good, and resonates with what is actually happening in reality that it's worth a little bit of a review. And again, we're sort of defining what the low point was historically 4 or 5 years ago. This is what's written to fledgling hospital administrators. To truly seize the reins of medicine, it is necessary to do more, to get into the heads and hearts of physicians. Physicians have long seen the doctor-patient relationship as the very center of the healthcare system. And as we go forward, doctors and patients must be made to feel that this relationship is not the sun around which everything else orbits, but rather one of the dimmer planets, maybe Pluto or Neptune or Saturn. It's kind of way out there someplace. So even, administrators recognize the importance of the doctor-patient relationship and from their standpoint how that needs to be destroyed. And again, I think this is all fiction, but it certainly resonates. So, how do you do that? Well, number one, make healthcare incomprehensible to physicians. For example, make physicians increasingly dependent on complex systems outside their domain of expertise, such as information technology. That certainly makes sense. That's number one. Number two, promote a sense of insecurity among the medical staff. A comfortable physician is a confident physician. So what do? Fire one or more physicians, let everybody know. I mean, this is sort of what happens in an employment model, right? I mean, one of the other tips is, make medicine so complicated, so costly that doctors cannot handle it on themselves and that they have to go into an employment model with a hospital. Once you get them there, here's tip number three, and this circles back. Remember, I told you I was going to connect this to 1984. Right, which my son Andrew is reading and writing a term paper on. We're going to connect this back to Orwell's book, 1984, and here it comes. Tip number three, borrow terminology and methods from the manufacturing industry, right, productivity, that kind of stuff, to make doctors think of themselves as production line workers, not providers. Convince them that they are not working sufficiently hard and fast. Make them decision implementers, not decision makers. So again, this document is probably fiction, but the stuff that it's written here is so good and resonates so well. It was posted and reposted a zillion times after it was initially published. But clearly, this sounds just like Orwell's 1984. And one of the things in that book was where they would manipulate the language, right? Never underestimate the power of the manipulation of language. They would manipulate the language, and in the book they would actually eliminate words that allowed the people to organize or to dream or to think independently. And this is kind of the same thing, not quite as flagrant as the book, of course. Words aren't prohibited, but they are certainly replaced, right? We replace the term physician with the term provider, then that would be one of the best examples of that sort of thing. So we are getting near the end of the second segment. True, are we down to the last couple of seconds? We break right here? We're going to break right here. Thank you for listening. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. People all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
Did you miss the show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We're back. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I am your host for today, Dr. Mike Karuchak. I alternate weeks with my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, and he will be back here next week. We want to hear from you. We have a Twitter feed. If you want to send comments or share thoughts, go to @ and this is all caps and numbers, D4, the numeral 4, PCFDN. D as in dog, D numeral 4, PCFDN. We would love to hear from you and love to get some feedback on how you think we're doing here, how you think I'm doing here this morning. So we've been talking about lots of things this morning. In the first segment, we brought some breaking headlines from yesterday about the huge data breach that's just occurred, or at least just been found, at Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield, a company that does business in 13 states, regarded as the second largest private insurer, has a data breach of 80 million records of personal information, including names, dates of birth, social security numbers, supposedly no credit card information and supposedly no hardcore medical information. But, you know, who cares about the hardcore medical information? I don't really care if a hacker's got my potassium level. I don't think he can steal my identity with a chest x-ray result or a potassium level of the results of a pulmonary function test. But he sure as heck can steal it with a date of birth and a social security number and my name and billing address. So, you know, I don't see much consolation in the fact that the hardcore medical information wasn't stolen. I mean, in light of everything else, who cares? In the second segment, we talked about kind of what was the low point in physician advocacy and physician involvement, and played a couple of clips from President Obama talking about Obamacare before it was passed, that he was actually able to tell outrageous lies about how physicians do their job, how they work, the things that are important to us. And they were able to pull it off because all that outrageous crap that Obama said. And again, it was Obama, but it could have been any politician. This is not a Democratic, Republican, liberal, conservative thing. But the crap that's out there from the President of the United States all the way down through hospital CEOs, insurance CEOs, you know, all this stuff, all this propaganda goes out there and it sticks. And it sticks because doctors don't yet have a concerted way to respond to it. Well, in this segment, I think we're going to talk about the bright side. That there is a ray of hope, and I think thanks to groups such as Docs for Patient Care Foundation and a lot of other groups that are out there, I don't mean to suggest we're the only one, but I think we're seeing some movement, and I think we're seeing a little bit of a light at the end of the tunnel, perhaps. Hopefully it's not a train coming the other way, but two things have happened since I was here last, 2 weeks ago, that give a little hope, and the first is, again, something that happened this week, that the American Board of Internal Medicine has walked back its position on maintenance of certification. Now, we talked about this issue a lot with Dr. Armstrong when I was here a couple of weeks ago, and he gave us a great outline of what's going on with maintenance of certification. For those of you that didn't hear it or aren't familiar with it, this is the idea that it is no longer sufficient in this world for a doctor to do 4 years of college, 4 years of medical school, anywhere between 3 and 10 years of residency, take a board exam, both written and oral. It's a multi-day thing. And prove your worth as a physician. Prove your competence. Prove your expertise beyond a shadow of a doubt that that's no longer enough. That proof of competence, maintenance of certification is the term, right? Again, we have a very detached kind of term, maintenance of certification. Again, we manipulate language. They manipulate language to their ends. And here's a great method, right? Maintenance of certification sounds benign enough unless you understand what it means. But maintenance of certification basically says, after all that stuff you do, doctor, you still haven't proven to us that you're allowed to touch patients. You've got to continually, and it's currently a 2-year cycle for ABIM, for the American Board of Internal Medicine. But it looks like they've walked that back a little bit. And this is a very interesting letter that came from one doctor, I gotta go to the name, Richard J. Barron, president and CEO of the American Board of Internal Medicine. So here's the letter. And the language is impressive. It says, "Dear internal medicine community, ABIM clearly got it wrong." It's the lead sentence. "We launched programs that weren't ready and did not deliver a maintenance of certification program that was meaningful." God, he had to use that word meaningful. If you're in health IT, you hate the word meaningful because of meaningful use. "We want to change that." And they went through and basically said, "We got it wrong. We apologize. We're sorry." And to that result, the ABIM did some tangible stuff to walk back their current position and current requirements on maintenance of certification. The first is effective immediately. The board is suspending some of this extra crap, practice assessment, patient voice, patient safety requirements, all this patient satisfaction stuff is suspended for 2 years. They've made a language change. How interesting. We've been talking about language. They made a language change such that, you know, public reporting of a doctor's status in the ABIM no longer says meeting MOC requirements. It says participating in MOC. So they've recognized the language issue. They've softened some language. And they've done some other things. They've pledged not to hike the fees, and that's a big issue. And they've committed to sort of listening a little bit more. So, you know, I don't mean to suggest that the problem is gone, right? If you want to make the problem go away, get rid of MOC, right? The concept is flawed, but this is a start. This is a start, and if you're looking at how history is unfolding, I think it is a good demonstration that doctor advocacy is working. Slowly but surely, I think we're getting a little bit of movement. And it's easy to be cynical about this. I mean, you know, we can certainly talk about, you know, some of the what the cynics are saying, talking about the fact that, you know, this whole thing was created to make the board richer. That may be true. There's no question. I think I found a number and I couldn't re-verify, but something on the order of $357 million. $357 million was spent last year by physicians doing maintenance of certification. And that's just the money. I didn't talk about the time. So that's $357 million unavailable for patient care. Hundreds of thousands of physician hours not available for patient care. I mean, how many patients do you think we could buy insurance premiums for a year? I don't know. David, if we had $357 million, I haven't said hi to David yet. My apologies. David's here running the board doing the yeoman's job. How many insurance policies could you buy? You know, maybe $10,000 per year. At $10,000 per year, I can't do the math and talk at the same time, but you could certainly buy insurance for a hell of a lot of people and reduce the uninsured in America and get them quality, you know, private sector, non-Obamacare health plans with $357 million. Or to look at it from the time perspective, if doctors are spending thousands of hours doing MOC requirements, why not let them take those thousands of hours and go take care of patients in a free clinic? You know, I mean, it's the loss of time and money is unacceptable. And I'm glad that the first step has been made. Again, I don't want to slide into pessimism again here. The whole point of me bringing this up was good things are starting to happen. So, you know, if you're fence sitting, you know, please consider either financially supporting or donating your time to one of the groups. You know, ours is certainly available. Docs for Patient Care Foundation, you can go to our website, you can donate money or you can join up and donate time. But please join the effort. And the nice thing about our 501c3 is you don't have to be a physician to join the effort. Now is the time. I think we've demonstrated that, you know, we've got a crack in the armor. We've got a break in their foundation. I think the folks that are trying to bulldoze over medicine and take over are finding that they're seeing the pushback. They're seeing physician outrage finally beginning to hit the radar screen, to show up on the map. And this thing with the American Board of Internal Medicine is not the only one. We've had another piece of good news, and we talked about this a little bit last time, and Hal and I talked about it on January 7th, and me and Dick Armstrong talked about it a little bit. But there's been some news on the whole idea of this meaningful use program being changed. And again, a brief summary if you're not familiar. The meaningful use program put out by the government, this is the, you know, very misguided incentive and penalty program that has forced the adoption of electronic medical records by physicians. And it comes in a stage one, stage two, stage three kind of program. And you know, stage two has been problematic, to say the least, you know, compared to stage one. And so we have been advocating for, and we being a lot of people, advocating for some relaxation in the meaningful use stage two requirements for 2015. And I think we're going to get that because CMS, Center for Medicare Medicaid Services, has announced that they are going to reduce the reporting period from 365 days, right, every day in 2015, and we're already into that by 30 days plus, reduce that down to 90 days. And that effectively gives all of us another 9 months to figure this all out, because it is so confusing and so internally contradictory, to at least figure this thing out and get our information technology ducks in a row. And again, as we talked about before, that's just about an impossible task. But there is some ray of hope that we'll be able to meet those guidelines. Even that's the lesser of two evils. The real thing we need to do is just get rid of the meaningful use program. The whole thing is ill-conceived. But again, at least the doctor advocacy seems to be turning the tide, seems to be moving the ball a little bit. And so there was this announcement January 30th by Patrick Conway, CMS's chief medical officer, that they're going to do a bunch of things. You know, they're sort of in this comment period with the rule. So, you know, hopefully by the end of the first quarter, we've got, you know, something that we can work with. And I think the reason that the CMS was forced to come around was because, you know, there was a bill that had been introduced called the Flexibility in Health IT Reporting Act, which was going to reduce that period to 90 days anyway. And so I think the idea is, let's just take that off the table as a bill, and CMS sort of was wise to just sort of go along and do it themselves rather than be forced. And the statistics don't lie. As of December, only 4% of providers had been able to do the meaningful use stage two. You know, and I'm sure most of those are in large institutions. I don't know that there's anyone in a private practice setting that's been able to do meaningful use stage two. So, you know, the ball's starting to move, and that is that's gratifying. But we can't stop. Now's the time to push even harder. We've got more battles to fight. You know, we need to get rid of maintenance of certification completely. The concept is misguided, and all it's doing is sucking money and time out of the hands of physicians that really don't have any to spare. Number two, eliminate meaningful use completely. Same idea, misguided initiatives coming from the top of the pyramid. And then we've got two other ones that we need to talk about, which is ICD-10, and we need to fight that battle and get ICD-10 delayed again until we get more thoughts. And finally, SGR. The sustainable growth rate formula, which is going to, the latest patch is going to expire, I believe, at the end of March. I didn't have time to double check that, but it's not long. And pretty soon Congress is going to have to face that problem again, because if they don't, of course, Medicare reimbursements are going to drop by 20% or 30% or some number that's not going to be able to be worked with. And finally, last but not least, we have the battle to fight about what to do about Obamacare. And there's clearly a groundswell of support against it, both within the physician community and outside. But right now, the other party, the Republican Party, needs to figure out what its plan is going to be. Because to this point, there have been lots and lots of little plans and lots of sort of standalone concepts like allow insurers to sell across state lines, or, you know, get rid of this whole idea that, you know, health premiums are pre-tax if your employer gives it to you, and, you know, are after-tax if you buy it yourself. There's lots of little concepts out there. Speaker Boehner has apparently promised to the media. Speaker Boehner has said that the Republicans will get their act together. There will be enough consensus to come up with a single comprehensive plan, and that, you know, if and when Obamacare falls apart, either by a Supreme Court decision regarding government subsidies, which we'll hear about at the end of June, that we need to be ready with an alternative. We need to be ready to replace Obamacare with something else. We're at the end of the segment. It is 45 minutes after the hour. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak. Have you ever wondered what doctors talk about amongst themselves? If you do, join us on the Doctor's Lounge and hear the doctors' conversations amongst themselves. Join me and my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, every Thursday morning, 8 to 9 a.m.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We're back. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I am your co-host, your host for today, Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thank you very much for sticking with us all the way through the hour. We're in the final segment, 13 minutes before the hour. We are in the home stretch. We may have been saving the best for last, so don't go away. In the commercial break, you heard the Docs for Patient Care website. Again, I invite you to go to that website. I invite you to share your thoughts with us, and I invite you to support us. Right, we're making progress. I think we've proved the concept that if physicians get together and make their voices heard, good things happen. We have good things happening at the American Board of Internal Medicine. We have good things happening at CMS. It is possible. It can be done. Please join us. Support us financially. Give us your time. Give us your talent. You heard the website, docsforpatientcare.org. Go and support us. In the final segment, we're going to talk about something different. We've talked about the safety of our data. Now we're going to talk about the safety of physicians themselves, because the month of January was a bit of a scary month if you're a doctor, because there were actually not one but two. We all heard about the unfortunate loss of Dr. Michael Davidson at Brigham and Women's Hospital 2 weeks ago today. But there are actually two shootings during the month of January. But this is something we don't think about very much. But, you know, we figure our offices and our exam rooms are safe places to be. But, you know, the bottom line is maybe it's not so safe. And we'll talk about how safe it might be or might not be. But, you know, there's no question. When we go into an exam room with a patient and close the door, we're kind of vulnerable. And, you know, here's what happened. To review, 2 weeks ago today, cardiothoracic surgeon Dr. Michael Davidson was shot by one Stephen Passeri at Brigham and Women's Hospital. The shooter arrived at the clinic, walked in the front door, no metal detector, asked for the doctor by name. He was glad to come out and speak with this person. And then, you know, right outside an exam room door, the doctor was shot, then the patient shot himself. So we know a little bit about the details, but obviously with privacy laws, and maybe appropriately, we don't know all the details, but we do know that the shooter, the perpetrator, the one with the gun, apparently his mother was a patient of Dr. Davidson, and his mother died this past November. We don't know any other circumstances surrounding the death, but, you know, I think the motivation obviously has something to do with that. Dr. Davidson is survived by his wife, a plastic surgeon who is pregnant with their fourth child. And like me, it sounds like Dr. Davidson likes music and plays guitar and had a band called Off Label, which if you're a doc, you realize that's a great name for a band. Apparently, he did have a reputation of, you know, using, you know, existing instruments and drugs in novel ways. I like doing that too. So, you know, I'm reading, you know, what this doc was like, and, you know, we have a few things in common. It's a little bit chilling. But this was not the only doctor killing. It's the one that got all the publicity. But there was another one on the 6th of January. A physician was shot and killed at a VA clinic. So, you know, in terms of, you know, medical settings, perhaps the opposite end of the spectrum. A VA clinic in El Paso, Texas, was a Gulf War veteran who was a patient of this physician. Apparently it was a clinic for head injured patients that had some closed head injury issues. Now, the unique thing about this is that it was a VA setting, and why is that unique? Now, we've bashed the VA a whole bunch in prior shows. This really isn't a bashing, but it does show one thing that's unique about the VA, which is that a lot of the veterans' benefits that they get aren't just medical care. You know, you can be service connected for something. You can get disability for military service and actually just get a check in the mail, something to live on. And I'm not here to debate that concept, but I am here to highlight it, because it means that, you know, what that physician wrote in the medical record and what their recommendations were may have influenced the benefits this person was getting. And, you know, there's always a lot of pressure, I think, inside the VA system that, you know, providers document in such a way that supports patients getting benefits, getting that check in the mail. So, you know, there is some room, and again, we don't know, and we don't necessarily have to know, but we can speculate, as long as we acknowledge it's speculation, that perhaps this provider wrote something in a medical record that cost this person benefits or something like that. Apparently, there was a threat about 13 months before, in October of 2013, the shooter found the physician in a grocery store and said something to the effect of, "I know what you did, and I'm going to get you," or "you're going to pay for it," or something along those lines. So that example is unique for that particular reason. Then there's two more examples. Actually, I found a total of six. But a urologist in Newport Beach, California, was shot by a 75-year-old patient. Don't have any details. Reno, Nevada, another urologist, a Dr. Charles Goldoian, was shot and killed by an angry patient because of a botched vasectomy. It's hard to tell if the patient's symptoms after the procedure had anything to do with it, but there was a letter that the patient wrote, you know, joint pain, body aches, low energy, flu-like symptoms, full abdomen, burning armpits, chest pain, chronic fatigue syndrome, and apparently he blamed this all on the vasectomy. Now, I'm not a urologist. I don't know if the vasectomy has any potential to create those sort of symptoms. But whether they do or not, what bothers me about this particular case is maybe, and again, I am speculating in its highest and least reliable form, but, you know, sometimes, at least in my own experience, when patients have a long list of vague complaints, It's and you can't tie them to any sort of a diagnosis. You know, if we use the traditional, you know, medical model of, you know, biochemical, biomechanical model of a human being, you can't connect the dots. They tell you symptoms, but you can't come up with a diagnosis. You can't tie it back to their vasectomy in this particular example. And sometimes, and again, this is my experience, again, this is what makes doctors different, and that's why I bring it up. I bring it up, again, I tell you at the top of every show, doctors are different, medicine's different. Here, perhaps, is an example. That sometimes patients with vague complaints just need to be heard. And it took me a long time to understand that. It took me probably over 10 years to fully appreciate what that means and what the implications are. Sometimes patients come in, and all they want to do is talk about what they've got. All they want to do is vent. And sometimes all you need to be is a caring ear and a caring heart, and you just listen. And all they need to do is get it off their chest. And if at the end of that you say, well, gosh, that's, you know, I'm sorry that you feel that way, and that must be really difficult for you, but I don't really have any answers. I don't know of any pill or any operation that's going to directly address those things. But let's just talk about it and see if we can't come up with something, anything. And sometimes you do and sometimes you don't, but that process, and again, it takes time. It takes the one thing we don't have. It takes time. You know, there's no CPT code for it. There's no quality indicator box to check. There's no medicine reconciliation step that fixes that patient's problem. It's just an ear and a heart. A caring ear and a caring heart that can fix these things sometimes. And you wonder, and again, I'm not placing blame or suggesting any sort of moral judgment here, but when I've had patients in the past, it has struck me that if you just listen to them and talk to them, that they may be perfectly happy with the idea that you don't have a pill or you don't have an operation or you don't have another specialist. But we've all been guilty of failing that calling. We've all, and I certainly have, and I think any doc that's being honest with themselves and honest with you has to admit that sometimes we don't do that correctly and do it well every time, or don't respond to that call when it's placed right in front of us by a patient in an exam room. And in today's age of medicine, that sort of behavior is not rewarded, right? Gets back to that training manual for hospital executives, right? You know, teach the physicians they're not special. Teach the physicians to be as productive as possible. Teach the physicians to just, you know, crank the patients in and out, to churn them through, to make it a mill. Okay, enough of that. Let's go to the next example. I need to go to the next example because David's falling asleep over there. So this must not be very exciting, so we're going to move on to the next example. In September 2010, at Johns Hopkins University, Dr. David Cohen was shot and wounded by the son of one of his patients. And after wounding Dr. Cohen, the son shot and killed himself and his mother and the patient. So figure that one out. And apparently Johns Hopkins really did want to figure that one out, because apparently that incident inspired a study that was conducted. They reviewed 154 hospital-based shootings around the country from the year 2000 to the year 2011, which resulted in 235 deaths or injuries. The findings concluded there were actually three motivations for taking a gun into a healthcare facility and shooting your doctor or somebody else. The one was revenge. I think intuitively we get that one. Either you confuse the messenger with the message and think that that cancer diagnosis, that somehow the doc was responsible for that, or you feel that the doctor didn't treat you or your loved one well. So revenge would be one. Suicide would be one. And, you know, we see that in this Hopkins example and in the death of Dr. Davidson at Brigham and Women's. And then the third one caught me by surprise, which was euthanizing the relative, which I guess is what happened to Johns Hopkins. And, you know, the Hopkins shooting apparently combined all three motives. But the researchers concluded, and this may be all we have time for as we wrap up, the researchers concluded that because hospital shootings are so rare, you know, and because the shooter is targeting a very specific person, that metal detectors and other sort of generic security measures are not going to be that effective. So, you know, that's interesting. I was also puzzled to find this study showed that most hospital shootings occurred at hospital entrances or parking lots, but none of the stories that I found support that. So what do we learn from all this? What do we got? About a minute left, something like that. What do we learn from all this? What is it that motivates a patient or a family member to be so angry and frustrated that they feel the need to kill their doctor? Do some misguided folks confuse the messenger with the message? Or, you know, and hold the physician responsible for the diagnosis? Or perhaps, you know, the patient and family find themselves in an Orwellian kind of health system, right? We'll tie this back to 1984 again one more time. That the whole health system is so Orwellian and so impersonal, the providers are so distracted by so many other regulatory requirements, so many quality of care boxes to check, so many bureaucratic initiatives, that there's no time and energy left. There's no time and energy left to do what needs to be done so many times in my experience, which is to just be a caring ear and a caring heart and talk to the patients, give them a chance to vent And, you know, we could hopefully do a much better job if we were simply allowed to do that. Are we finished? Do I have any more time? We're done. We're about done. Thank you very much for listening. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. You have been listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.